Today on the 21st, the holidays are approaching and a vaccine is offering hope, but cases of COVID-19 are still surging across the U.S. Traveling to see loved ones could be a risk. We'll revisit a conversation with two experts on how to stay safe and what steps we can take if holiday travel is essential. Then, love in a time of pandemic. 9 months in, how have people been dating? And what are the safest ways to do so? And tonight is the winter solstice, the darkest evening of the year, but a little brighter in 2020 thanks to a rare astronomical sight called a Great Conjunction. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on the 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, and WNIJ in DeKalb. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Our show airs 4 days a week, often bringing you two or three topics a day. When you add that up, we've covered a lot of ground and interviewed quite a few people across Illinois and some around the globe. So in these final weeks of the year, we wanted to take the opportunity to revisit some of those conversations you may have missed or that we at the 21st think are worth a second listen. With cases of COVID-19 surging across the Midwest, traveling to see loved ones could be a big risk. So what are some tips to travel safely if it's absolutely essential? And how much does testing before we set out make a difference? Just before Thanksgiving, we sought answers from two experts. And as we approach the holidays, we thought now would be a great time to revisit that interview with Becky Smith, an epidemiologist and associate professor of pathobiology at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. We were also joined by Erica Hartman. She's an assistant professor of civil and environmental engineering at Northwestern University. She researches indoor microbiology and chemistry. A note, since we initially recorded this conversation just ahead of Thanksgiving, there are quite a few references to that holiday, but we think it's still timely as we approach the Christmas season. I started by asking Professor Smith about the best way to test for COVID-19 before traveling. Professor Smith, if someone is lucky enough to have access to testing, like many of the students and staff do at the University of Illinois, or maybe they're able to get a rapid test in their community, what sort of testing schedule would you recommend before someone might go visit family for Thanksgiving?
So the absolute ideal is to have two negative tests 4 days apart, and to make sure that in between those tests and after those tests, that you limit any possibility of infection by limiting your social interactions as much as possible. If you can't get access to two tests and you only have access to one test, I recommend doing a full 2 weeks of self-quarantine. So it's a little late to start that for Thanksgiving, but to maintain a full 2 weeks of self-quarantine before you get your test and then go for your Thanksgiving. And remember that the test only tells you where you are right now. So you're going to want to be careful to make sure that you don't get infected in the days leading up to the test. And then we might not be able to detect the infection yet, or between the test and when you see your family.
So don't get a test and then go hang out with a bunch of friends in an indoor space and then get another test, you know, a day later, knowing that, I mean, you may have been infected. The virus might not show itself in that time. What factors should people weigh in their Thanksgiving plans as they assess their level of risk to either contracting or spreading COVID? I mean, in a lot of cases, it's not a simple, yes, it's safe to travel. No, it's not safe to travel. What are the most important things for people to think about?
So among the things that you should think about, and I'm not going to manage to get to all of them because there are a lot, but among the things you should think about is the people that you're meeting with, are any of them in high risk categories? Are you at high risk for being infected in the course of your travel? So can you travel safely? Traveling in your own car is fairly safe. If you have to travel by long distance bus or by plane, there's a little bit more risk. Especially with planes, the risk during the airport time rather than the airplane time. So how can you travel and can you do it safely? There's also thinking about what you've been doing for the last couple of weeks. Remember, I said we can't even detect infections for the first couple of days after they happen. And if you don't have access to testing, it can be up to 2 weeks before symptoms appear. So if you have not been self-quarantining for the last 2 weeks, if you've been having a lot of social activities, then it may not be safe to go mix with other people. You should also think about what the other people have been doing as well. So for instance, my family has been extremely safe. We've been self-quarantined since March, really. I would love to go see my sister, but her children are in school and in sports, so we won't, because we know that their risk is higher than ours.
Yeah, just safeguarding your own pod activities, or knowing that you need to know what everybody else is doing. When you mentioned quarantine and after getting a test, not doing anything that could put yourself at risk, are you saying not going to parties, or even something like not getting takeout, not going to a grocery store?
So getting takeout is a fairly low-risk activity. Going to a grocery store where you are masked and where everybody else in the grocery store is masked and you keep your distance, it's a fairly low-risk activity. But you don't want to be going to parties. You don't want to be getting together with small groups of people, even if you're getting together indoors, and especially if you're not going to be masked around them. So think about the amount of time that you're spending near people, whether or not you're wearing a mask, and whether or not those people are following the same protections as you are. And remember, your risk is equal to that of the riskiest person that you interact with.
Yeah, it's such an important point. Erica Hartman, I want to bring you into the conversation now. Early on in this pandemic, a lot of the advice was around sanitizing everything, sanitizing your hands, cleaning anything you're bringing into your home from the outside world. I remember at one point we were wiping down packages we had delivered. We were wiping down groceries. I think our understanding of this virus has evolved. We now know that because the virus is spread primarily through the air, that mask wearing is essential. Much more so than sanitizing surfaces. Can you talk about, let's say somebody is going to travel, right? You're sitting down on a plane or a train. In addition to wearing a mask, should you be trying to sanitize the area around you physically?
First off, I would say that's a great summary of sort of what we've learned so far. We did originally think that fomites or viruses on surface potentially played a really big role in disease transmission here. And we now know that that's probably not the case. I would say that at this point, I would not focus on sanitizing the space around me, but do be conscious of what you're touching. And so while you're sort of in transit, avoid touching your face.
That's the key thing, right? You don't want to put especially your eyes, you're near your nose or your mouth, because that's where you can possibly infect your, I guess, mucous membranes, right?
Exactly. So the chances that you would encounter sort of virus on a surface are pretty low. So at this point, I would not recommend trying to disinfect all of the surfaces around you, also because there can be some pretty undesirable side effects to sort of overexposure to antimicrobials and cleaning products and disinfectants. So I don't think it's a good idea to go around and try to sanitize everything, but just being mindful that in the unlikely event that you have touched a surface that's contaminated, to make sure that you're not exactly rubbing your eyes or scratching your nose or anything like that.
So if we were preparing for a trip, are there any particular products that you would recommend people keeping on hand? I use the word hand. Hand sanitizer springs to mind, possibly.
I mean, I think hand sanitizer is not a bad idea to just sort of have in general, but I don't think that there's anything specifically related to cleaning and hygiene that's going to make travel that much safer.
Okay. It's interesting because that was so ingrained in us early on, the importance of that sort of thing. And it just seems like our information has changed significantly. So, I mean, even people pumping gas or something like that and, you know, using a wipe to pick up the gas pump. I mean, is that, at least in terms of COVID, not really something that people need to worry about, it sounds like.
I would still recommend cleaning your hands after any activity like that, especially if you're thinking about maybe if you're driving a long distance, you're not going to be wearing your mask in your car. You may sort of forget and rub your eyes anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that case, I would still recommend practicing good hand hygiene. I would say certainly in any circumstance where you don't think you can keep in mind to not be touching your face or rubbing your eyes.
If you're just tuning in, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're revisiting a conversation we had just before Thanksgiving with Becky Smith, an epidemiologist at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and Erica Hartman, a professor of civil and environmental engineering at Northwestern. It's about how to travel safely in the pandemic. Let's get back to the interview. Professor Smith, are there modes of transportation that are more or less risky? I mean, how would you rate, you know, saying flying compared to driving, as compared to taking a train or a bus?
So again, it's not necessarily the mode of transportation that you think about, but how much contact do you have with people who are outside of your bubble during the course of that transportation? So driving in your own car is quite safe because you're not coming into contact with other people for the most part. Carpooling with one other person is safe as long as you know that other person has been taking similar precautions. But if it's a carpool arranged with a stranger, not so much. Again, being on trains or being on buses, how much distance can you put between yourself and other people? Is everybody wearing a mask? And is everybody avoiding getting too close to each other? As I said earlier, on flying, the risk on airplanes is actually quite low just because airplanes are set up to circulate the air quickly and easily and to disinfect the air. So I'm not as worried about airplanes as long as everybody, again, is masked and keeping distance. But what I worry about is in airports, it can be very difficult to keep your distance within airports. So you want to be more careful within the airport and within the plane loading procedures rather than necessarily sitting on the plane in flight, but keep your mask on. If you're taking any form of public transit, keep your mask on and try to keep your distance.
I heard somebody talking on a different program about how great everybody was on the flight about wearing their masks, and the airline was good about enforcing it. And then they distributed the snacks and everybody took their masks off at the same time to eat their snacks on the plane, which seems like kind of defeats the purpose of that. You know, I was also wondering, a friend of mine is planning to travel next week. This person expressed concern to their family about using highway rest areas. And their partner responded by buying a portable toilet with a privacy screen. Is that a good idea? Do you have a view on whether highway rest areas or gas station bathrooms, that sort of thing, is high risk, low risk, medium risk?
Highway restrooms are actually my biggest concern about driving. The question would be, are they group restrooms? In which case there might be contact, there might be multiple people in there at the same time. Are they single use restrooms? And if so, did somebody just leave? In which case we do know that there can be some aerosols remaining in the air that could be infectious, or have they left for a while? And with restrooms, you get into what Dr. Hartman could talk about a little bit more with the high touch surfaces and the fact that you might be more likely to be touching your face when you've just walked into a restroom, might want to adjust your mask or look in the mirror. So thinking more about those sorts of things rather than the particular location.
Sure. Well, Professor Hartman, can you weigh in on that? Rest area bathrooms, you know, frankly, I personally find them kind of horrifying even when we're not in a global pandemic. What is your view from a public health standpoint of that?
That's a fair enough assessment. I do know in general, the surfaces of buildings around us do tend to look like us. So the microbes that you would find on surfaces that you touch with your hands look sort of like the microbes on your hands. And so certainly on high touch surfaces, there's a lot of potential both for sort of deposition of microbes and picking them back up. And we do want to be very, very mindful of exactly not touching a surface and then touching your face. And when there's a mirror present, there's always that temptation exactly to fix your hair or your mask or whatever. I can't say whether or not you should use them. I do think the consideration of exactly how many people are there and How recently it's been used is probably more critical than thinking about the high touch surface aspect.
Professor Smith, I did want to ask you about, you mentioned air travel and the high level of air exchange. Do you have a view on, I know certain airlines are now selling middle seats, selling, you know, and some are still advertising that they're not. I mean, is that something that people should keep in mind, trying to keep that little bit of extra distance if they can in mid-flight? Or is the air exchange such that that's not as much of a concern anymore, do you think?
So I absolutely would not be comfortable sitting right next to somebody having a middle seat filled on an airplane. When I talk about the air exchange happens within the row of the airplane. And so anybody who is within your row is still potentially exchanging air with you. So I would be concerned about having a middle seat next to me filled.
Okay. And bottom line, I guess, in about three sentences is about all we have time for. Do you have any final recommendations for people to think about travel this holiday season? Stay, go? What's the safest thing to do?
I recommend staying and getting creative with ways to make new traditions or fun, creative adaptations to old traditions.
Zoom Thanksgiving is what we're planning in my family and with our extended family, too. And we're doing a sort of cruise ship thing where we'll have, as one relative put it, a very detailed schedule with multiple opportunities for connection over a couple of days. Anyway, I want to thank Becky Smith. She's an epidemiologist, associate professor of pathobiology at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, as well as Erica Hartman, assistant professor of civil and environmental engineering at Northwestern. Thank you both for sharing your knowledge with us today on the 21st.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
Coming up after a short break, dating in the pandemic, plus the Great Conjunction. This is the 21st. Stay with us. This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. On today's show, as we approach the end of the year, we're looking back on some of our favorite conversations that we think are still timely. And sadly, our segment about dating during the pandemic still applies. Gone for now are the days of casual dating, at least in the traditional sense. And couples who would normally meet each other's family this time of year, well, that's also off the holiday table. But hearts will find a way, as our next guests will tell you. So nearly 10 months into the pandemic, how have people been dating, and what are the safest ways to do so? Last month, I spoke with Bella Gandhi, the founder of the Smart Dating Academy in Chicago, a date coaching business that teaches professionals how to date. She explained how dating has changed because of the pandemic and has advice for how to connect with people in the dark winter months. We were also joined by Christopher Maniotis, a researcher at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign who studies rituals and relationships. Whether you're content being single, partnered, or you're optimistic about finding love in the midst of a global pandemic, we think you'll enjoy the interview. Here now is that conversation. Bella, I want to begin with you. When the pandemic first kind of gained attention in this country or mid-March or so, what were some of the concerns you heard from clients who suddenly couldn't see the people they were dating?
Yeah, it's like for, you know, the entire world shut down, right, Brian, for 2 weeks and dating apps, everything just went dark. But I think as the poignancy of life being unplugged and 48% of adults in this country are single, people by the end of March and April started getting back on the dating apps, right? And I would have my clients do that, like, you know what, continue to do this and make connections through FaceTime and Zoom, but rapidly, you know, what Match and Bumble and Tinder had tried to do for a decade and incorporate video into the app, suddenly they did that. And so making connections via video has been game changing, I think, overall, and especially for our clients. We've had people connect and fall in love.
And have the sort of concerns of people evolved over time as, you know, pandemic fatigue has set in, or are clients still mostly content to at least start with these digital tools?
Yeah, I think right now nobody ever comes to me saying, oh my gosh, I'm so excited about online dating at all. But what they're like, okay, you're going to make me do this as well as my dating coach. Yeah, absolutely. But I think I always tell people online dating is the world's largest cocktail party. And now during the pandemic, it's an even bigger cocktail party that you definitely want to be part of. So starting out, you know, if the three major pipelines to meeting people in life, that's how I boiled it down. Number one is through dating apps. Number two is meeting people in real life. And the third is getting set up by people, right? The last two, we're not doing so much of at this point with pandemic. So it's really pushing on that lever of technology to meet people.
Yeah. Well, and Business Insider is projecting, I think, an 18%+ increase in smartphone dating apps usage this year over last year. Bill, I saw in the Sun Times your business doubled apparently since the pandemic began. Why do you think people are being driven this way?
You know, I think that more than the pandemic, I think what that, the doubling of our business, which is true, what it enabled me to do is become more comfortable with Zoom as a technology and a way to build chemistry with clients. Whereas before we were high touch, meeting people at the Four Seasons in Chicago. So as we started to pivot our business to continue to help our clients date and onboarding people and teaching people through Zoom, I thought, wow, we can actually start to teach more people in groups of 10 and 20. And so that's how our business has grown this year. So it's been a really interesting phenomenon. You know, everybody hates COVID-19. But I guess for us, everybody, you know, trying to find that silver lining, that's been one for us, is really getting comfortable with the, you know, the amazingness of what video connections can do.
Chris Meniotis, your research shows that rituals like celebrating holidays or weekly movie nights can lead to couples taking those next steps in their relationships. Can you talk, before we get into how the pandemic might have disrupted that, how do those routines advance relationships?
Yeah, definitely. So those rituals and routines really allow couples to see their partner in a new light, to gain perspective. All of the things that come attached to rituals and routines, say the holidays, you know, meeting family, those interactions, they provide, they're sort of like a diagnostic tool for individuals, and they provide a greater depth for individuals understanding their partner and how that partner may fit into the family if they choose to take those next steps into marriage.
So now that these normal routines have been more or less disrupted because of the pandemic, do you have any recommendations for what couples can do to continue trying to develop those relationships? Are there ways to do some of these rituals virtually, or to establish, I mean, are you hearing about new virtual rituals that people are doing?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a good question there. And, you know, in terms of a ritual that maybe a lot of couples have of starting a new TV show together, something virtual now would be Netflix has a sharing option and being able to, you know, still engage in that ritual together, but apart. But I think another thing couples can really do is also discuss their expectations together. And so in my research with rituals, a clash of expectations was problematic and could lead to conflict. So being able to discuss whether the expectation is actually seeing each other or about the ritual itself, say, you know, the holidays, whatever those expectations are, being on the same page to sort of minimize that potential for conflict.
Well, geez, how much relationship strife really comes down to a clash of expectations, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. It really does.
But Bella, I wonder if you can weigh in. So during the summer, right, people have this opportunity to still, I mean, maybe they're meeting online more, but there is still an opportunity to do something that is similar to dating before the pandemic, even if it's socially distanced outside. You know, people still want to date in the winter, though. And for some, there's an even greater imperative maybe to find someone with whom to spend those cold winter months, you know, be it casual hookups. Some people call this cuffing season, basically short-term relationships. What does a safe winter, a safe cuffing season look like during the pandemic?
Well, you know, it's a good question. As more and more states take on more and more restrictions, right? There's not indoor dining gone, bars gone. Like, where do we go? You know, the festivals that we would normally have aren't happening in the ways that they were. So ultimately, I think it's going to remain to be seen what people can do as the regulations come, you know, change on a weekly basis. But right now, what we're having our clients do is not rushing into socially distant states at this point, because when we're dating, I want people to have a dating funnel, right? And so you don't want to put yourself potentially at risk by starting to meet all these different people in person, because who knows who that person's been with? Let's just go there for a second. So really taking advantage of creating connections with people via video, and not just one, but you might do several. And like, you know, Christopher was saying, you can cook dinner together, you can do different things together to build that emotional intimacy before you actually meet up for a socially distanced date. Maybe in Chicago, you can go for a walk and grab a coffee or a hot chocolate and go walk around neighborhoods where the decorations are pretty, right? It's really about being creative if you're not comfortable, you know, Netflixing and chilling in somebody's house right away.
Yeah, and I mean, setting aside the public health epidemiological questions, we'll just say, you know, let's say that people are doing the right thing, that are quarantining, staying isolated. At what point do you recommend people maybe take that step away from the virtual dating to maybe seeing someone in person, be it socially distanced or maybe sort of bringing them into your pod or into your bubble, so to speak?
I think it really depends on each individual person's risk tolerance, right? And so I think for what I tell my clients is when you're ready to go on that socially distanced date. So I don't have any hard rules per se, like by day four, you can meet people in person, because for some people that's just, you know, they're taking care of aging parents or whatever that is, or maybe they're immunocompromised. So it really depends on each individual person as to when they're ready to move to socially distanced dates. But on the other poll, I will tell you, I have people that, you know, will message with somebody and they want to go straight to a socially distanced date. So people really range the spectrum right now.
Listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Bella Gandhi, founder of the Smart Dating Academy in Chicago, and Christopher Maniotis, who's a researcher at the University of Illinois, studies rituals and relationships. If you want to share some of your dating experiences in the pandemic, the number to call is 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. Bella, we received a voice memo from Constance, who's actually in Michigan. Here's what she had to say.
Hi, my name's Constance. Thanks for having me on the show. Throughout the pandemic, I've been taking the time to explore my identity, which has been great for my confidence and just really understanding who I am. But I haven't been able to use that for dating so far because I can't go out and meet people. And it's given me a little bit of a better understanding for like online dating, but that hasn't been working out well for me so far. So what kind of advice would you give to someone who has this new understanding of their identity, but is trying to start dating in now of all times?
So Bella, I think regardless of someone's identity, everyone first has to be introspective and think about maybe what they want in a relationship. And part of that is knowing more about yourself. What tips do you have for that? Is there an opportunity during this pandemic to sort of do that self-discovery that's part of dating?
Yeah, you know, when we're working with clients, Brian, we do something called the marriage map, which, you know, we use marriage synonymously with long-term committed relationship, partnership, but it's really looking introspectively and maybe taking a walk down memory lane and doing some analyses of your previous relationships, right? What attracted you to this person? What worked? What didn't work? What was your partner's responsibility in the breakup? What was yours? And really putting together this constellation of data points where you're like, oh man, wow, I see I've got a pattern towards, you know, people that are narcissistic or they're commitment phobic or whatever that is. So first of all, it's understanding what you might be prone to or what you have been tolerating, and then changing the focus. And from our standpoint, we call them high GPQ people, high and good partner qualities, and then really ascertaining who is a partner that's going to make you happy. right? And how do you want to feel with this person? And instead of getting stuck in so many quantitative metrics, I want them to be this tall and make this much money and have this education level, right? It's like, how do you want to feel when you're with this person? So it's really turning that process over on its head. And I think that if you don't have your own full-time dating coach, I think that doing some of that introspection during the pandemic is really important to getting yourself out there to know what you want so that you've got a good roadmap to find it.
Chris, I want to ask you, you study as well as relationships, relationship transitions in particular. Can you talk about maybe when it's time to stop seeing someone, even if it is mostly or only a virtual relationship?
Yeah, I think it's somewhat on an individual level. But yeah, when it becomes harmful in any way to the individual, emotionally, physically, of course, anything like that, would be time to stop. And I know, kind of connecting with what Bella talked about in my research with rituals and couples, sort of taking inventory of the relationship, past relationships, all of that. Rituals are a really good time that really signal to couples to be able to do that. And so, yeah, it's a key part of understanding when it's time to stop and when it's time to continue and even continue into marriage if that's the next step they would like.
You know, in just the few minutes we have remaining, I want to take a step back here. Chris, do you think that the pandemic is going to permanently change dating for this generation of people who are at that, you know, experiencing it in that way at that time in their lives?
You know, I would say it's a little too soon to tell just yet, but we know through decades of relationship research that relationships do evolve, and the way people date evolves over time and is very connected to society and broader concerns like COVID. So it wouldn't be surprising to see if it did have some impact, you know, especially in the area of technology use, as we've discussed that a lot. But I would say it's still a little too soon to tell for that.
Yeah. Bella, in just the couple of minutes we have remaining, I wonder if I can ask you for, you know, Zoom can be awkward. First dates can be awkward. Zoom plus first dates equals awkward squared. Do you have any good tips for first dates on Zoom?
Yeah. Assess your own appearance and your own background, right? So much of this is how you're feeling internally, as we were talking about doing that introspection and who am I and how do I feel, and really making sure that you have the tactics right here, right? Have good lighting, right? Maybe make sure that you're facing your light source. Never be backlit, or then you'll have weird shadows on your face. So if you've got nice windows in your living room, maybe face those, or, you know, get a table lamp in front of you, or a ring light if you really want to soup up your game. And your background should also look good. You don't want it to look, you know, weird and cluttered, because people are drawing first impressions about you and you're inviting them into your space for the first time. So I would rather have people have a white wall in the background than something that looks really cluttered and messy and just sends off the wrong image. And you just need one nice place in your house or a nice corner to be able to do that. And then take stock of how you look, right? You want to look like you respect yourself and you respect the person that you're with, and dress like you would if you were going out to meet somebody for drinks.
Bella Gandhi is the founder of the Smart Dating Academy in Chicago. We've also been speaking with Christopher Maniotis, who's a researcher in the Department of Human Development and Family Studies at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Bella, Chris, thanks so much for being with us and talking about dating in a pandemic today on the 21st.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We need to take a break in a moment, but before we do, I want to make a pitch for a holiday gift of sorts. It's the 21st podcast. If you listen to us on the radio, sometimes you might not be able to tune in if you're not in the car or just on a Zoom call, perhaps, when we're on the air, but you can always listen to the 21st anytime, 24/7, through our podcast. You can find all the ways to download us. We're on Spotify, as well as Apple Podcasts and NPR One. You can find all that on our website, which is 21stshow.org. And if you know somebody who is interested in the politics, culture, and other happenings in Illinois, you think they would enjoy the 21st, why not share our podcast with them? It makes a great holiday gift. Coming up after the break, the Great Conjunction in the night sky. Just look up tonight. We'll hear more after a short break. Stay with us. This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Last week on the show, we had a conversation that will be particularly relevant tonight. December 21st marks the winter solstice in the Northern Hemisphere, the darkest evening of the year, but a little brighter in 2020 thanks to a rare astronomical sight called a Great Conjunction. The planets Jupiter and Saturn will be lined up in the sky. A version of this happens every couple decades, but this year is special. It's the closest our solar system's largest planets have appeared in centuries. Michelle Nichols joined us to explain more. She's director of public observing at the Adler Planetarium in Chicago and author of the book Astronomy Lab for Kids. We started by asking her to explain exactly what will happen in the night sky tonight during the Great Planetary Conjunction. So, Michelle, let's start with a basic question. What is the true nature of space and time? No, I'm just kidding.
The answer is 42. No, sorry. That's the answer to life, the universe, and everything. Yeah. Yes.
Let's start with a different basic question. What is a planetary conjunction?
A conjunction refers to essentially when something appears close to something else in the sky. And so in this particular case, it is Jupiter appearing close to Saturn in the sky. And when two things are near each other in the sky, as viewed from Earth, in reality, these objects are very far apart, but when they're near each other in the sky, that's called a conjunction. And in this case, a Jupiter and Saturn conjunction happens to also be called a great conjunction. And those, as you said, happen about every 20 years. But occasionally they get especially close. And so that is the peak of that is happening on Monday, December 21st.
And I was going to ask, that was my next question. What makes this great? I read that the sort of apparent visual distance between the planets will be about the thickness of a dime held in arm's length.
Yeah, so to put it in sky terms, it's 1/10 of 1 degree or 1/5 the diameter of the full moon in the sky. So pretty close, not enough to merge or anything like that. They're still going to be distinct objects. But you can already see this. They're in the sky low to the southwest after sunset. So if you've been seeing them, if you've been watching them over the last few weeks, Jupiter and Saturn have appeared to get closer and closer and closer. And one of my colleagues photographed the two last night. He was able to get both of them in the same eyepiece view through the telescope. And that is something that is really cool to see.
Yeah, that's got to be getting, and they're only going to get closer together as we approach the solstice, right? I guess you can up the magnification.
Just a bit closer, yeah.
Well, let's come back to the actual sort of mechanics of viewing it if you have a telescope or binoculars a little later. Mm-hmm. But some people are calling this a Christmas star. I guess if you squint or if you're nearsighted, that it might look like a single point of light.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. They might appear to be closer or anything like that, but for most of us, they're going to appear as two distinct objects. They're not that close. If Jupiter actually passes in front of Saturn as seen from Earth, that's called a mutual occultation. That can happen, although the last time it happened was about 8,000 years ago. So that doesn't happen often at all. But I think it's because this particular one is happening near Christmas. They don't all happen near Christmas. Most of the time it's not near Christmas. So this one just happens to be. So it sort of got the moniker of the Christmas star.
Interesting. Well, you mentioned 8,000 years ago. We don't have to go back that far to look at a lot of attention has been given to the year 1623 and before that, mm-hmm. 1226, I guess, is the last time this was broadly visible.
Yeah. So the one in 1623 was in July. July 16th, 1623 is when Jupiter and Saturn were at a similar distance apart as they are now in our sky. The problem was, though, those two were lost in the glare of the setting sun. And so unless you knew this was going to happen, you probably missed it. And so the time before that, when they were that close, actually even a little closer, and it was far enough away from the sun that you could see it, was March of the year 1226.
Wow. I did not go back that far in my research, but I was curious about trying to wrap my head around 1623. And I looked up notable events from that year. I thought the most interesting one was that was the first folio, Shakespeare's, the first collection of Shakespeare's work posthumously was published that year, 1623. So let's maybe we can go over some of the ways that people might see this once-in-a-lifetime conjunction, naked eye, binoculars, consumer telescope. Let's start with the naked eye. Any tips for heading out to see this?
Yep, absolutely. So if it happens to be clear out where you are anytime over about the next 2 weeks, you've got time. And we know that December in Illinois can be cloudy. So go outside anytime it's clear, just after sunset. And you want to go out maybe 30, 40 minutes after sunset. Face to the southwest, you will see two relatively bright objects. The brighter one is Jupiter, the dimmer one is Saturn. And over the next couple weeks, you'll see them appear to change their orientation with respect to each other. What you're seeing is the change, the movement of Jupiter through the Saturn to the solar system, and the movement of Earth through the solar system, changing our perspective a little bit. If you have binoculars, you can point them, and I guarantee you'd get them in the same view. If you have a small telescope, even with just moderate magnification, you'll get them in the same eyepiece view, which is really neat to see the rings of Saturn and the disk of Jupiter all at the same time. And if you're lucky, you'll probably see some moons as well.
Yeah, I'm probably not doing something right. I have a small telescope that I pull out into the backyard sometimes. I can see the moons of Jupiter more easily than the bands. I think I'm still figuring out the focus and the eyepieces, though, as an amateur.
Or it could be.
Go ahead.
It's pretty low in the sky, so maybe Jupiter's a little too fuzzed out to see the bands. And also, it might depend on your focus, like you said, of your telescope. So, yeah, just play around with that a little bit. But don't get too discouraged if you can't see the bands on there. You kind of need a little bit of extra magnification to be able to see that. So it's just fine if you can just see the disk and the moons.
Realistic expectations, too. People should not expect Hubble Space Telescope type photos in backyard astronomy. If you're just tuning in, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're revisiting our conversation about the Great Conjunction. This is a rare astronomical event. It's happening tonight, December 21st. Jupiter and Saturn will appear to nearly touch in the night sky. It hasn't happened in centuries. My guest was Michelle Nichols, Director of Public Observing at the Adler Planetarium in Chicago and author of the book Astronomy Lab for Kids. Let's get back to the conversation. This is a rare astronomical event that people should be able to see even in reasonably bright lights, big city conditions, right?
Absolutely. Yes. But
if people do want to head out into the country, any tips on finding darker skies without, you know, having to fly to Utah or something like that?
The pandemic has actually made this an extremely hard question to answer, because a lot of places have changed their hours when they might be open, parks and such. So it is almost impossible for us to recommend specific locations. But one thing that I have kind of come up with that seems to help is look at the map of Illinois state parks and county parks and all that. If there's one that is near you, give them a call and call up ahead of time and say, hey, I want to try to come out. I notice it's going to be clear in 3 nights. Can I come out and just hang out in the parking lot for a couple hours? They may say no, but they may say yes. So my philosophy is if you don't ask, the answer's no. So just ask and see if there is a spot where you could go safely that you won't get locked in to the park. Sometimes they lock the gates. But just see if there's a county or state park that might allow you to stay the evening for a few hours anyway.
Yeah, special case, special pleading in this case. I also
you probably also won't be the first person to ask.
Yeah, that's true too. There's also an app I use. I don't know if you're familiar with this, called Dark Sky, which shows sort of a map of the United States with sort of, it's kind of like a heat map where the more light pollution you have, the brighter it is on the map. So you can sort of find a country road or something, if it's safe to pull off to.
Exactly.
To look up
another online version of that is lightpollutionmap.info. So you can go and see and search for certain areas, and it'll, and if you put in a spot, it'll drop a little pin as to where it might be good to go to, or at least it'll show you the spot that you've picked, whether or not it's good from a light pollution perspective. But one thing I want to bring up is there is an International Dark Sky Association Night Sky Park as part of the Champaign County Forest Preserves. It is Middle Fork River Forest Preserve. And it is a resource right nearby, a little bit northeast of Champaign. And call them up, see if you can go hang out there. They do have camping. I don't know what the current situation is because of the pandemic, but just go on their website, see what the arrangements are. And that is actually a great place to go that isn't too far away.
Okay, good tip for our listeners in Central Illinois. So, are there any other astronomical phenomena? That's a phrase I'm not going to write into a script again. Are there any other astronomical phenomena to look out for in the coming weeks? Go ahead.
Yep, sorry. The peak of the quadranted meteor shower is late the evening of January 2nd into the early morning of January 3rd. The peak of that particular meteor shower is usually only about 6 hours long. So this isn't one of those meteor showers where I can say, if you miss it, just wait a day and you just will see fewer. You probably will see hardly any if it's not clear where you are. But these meteor showers happen every year. So if you miss it this year, you can go, or 2021, you can check it out again in 2022. So it'll be the peak. It will be the evening, late the evening of the 2nd into like after midnight to about 3 or 4 in the morning on January 3rd. And it's one of the better ones of the year usually.
Okay. Last thing I want to ask you about, you might be aware that presently University of Illinois Aerospace Engineering alum Mike Hopkins is on the International Space Station. He was commander of the Crew 1 mission to get he and other astronauts there. We're actually scheduled to interview him from space in January on the 21st. I understand our listeners can try to see the International Space Station passing overhead sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. And as a fellow University of Illinois physics department alum, I am very proud of Mike Hopkins. So go Illini. You can see if the space station will be visible from your location. An easy way to do it is go to spotthestation.nasa.gov and put in your location. And the database doesn't cover every single town, but just pick a nearby town. It'll be close enough. And you just click on it, and it will tell you when the space station will be visible, what direction to look, how long it will be visible for, and how high up in the sky to look. And so it's spotthestation.nasa.gov. And there's another one called Heavens Above, heavens-above.com. You can put in your location and it will also tell you when the space station will be visible. I saw it just a few nights ago as it passed just a few degrees above Jupiter and Saturn. So that was a special sight.
Oh, very nice. All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Michelle Nichols is Director of Public Observing at the Adler Planetarium in Chicago. Great information today. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
That was a conversation we recorded last week about the Great Conjunction, as it's called, of Jupiter and Saturn. It's happening this evening. Look up in the night sky. All the rest of this week and next week, we'll be bringing you some conversations that you might have missed and that we think are certainly worth another listen. That is all the time we have for today's show. We go out with Gustav Holst. This is Jupiter, the bringer of jollity from the planets. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Thank you.